team building, one of the very important roles of the masculine individual, the responsibility of building your family into a team. Or, you know, if we're talking about just husband and wife, even building that relationship into a team if you don't have children. Let's look at what team means, first of all, looking in Webster's dictionary. A number of persons associated together in work or activity. That's a definition of a team. A number of persons associated together in work or activity. It's from an old English word, teme, T-E-M-E, which meant offspring. See, so it is related to a family. You don't normally think of a team being a family, but that's precisely where the word came from. Teamwork, all members subordinating personal prominence to the efficiency of the whole. What a beautiful definition of teamwork. All members taking their own personal interests and putting them in subjection to the interests and the efficiency of the whole. That's really teamwork. And you know, it's beautiful to see teamwork in action. Fantastic. You know, to see a group of men, for instance, work together in teamwork action. Boy, with television lenses the way they are, with instant replay, with stop action and with slow motion action, it's fantastic to watch 11 men on a football squad. I'm just fascinated in football season. I can hardly wait for it to come around again. To sit there and watch men work together as a team. On the other hand, it's kind of ridiculous to see a group of people that are supposed to be working together and that are not, you know, and they're kind of working at odds. We have a saying in our metro division that if you break formation in a large unusual occurrence, and in other words in a riot, that the officer that breaks formation better keep right on going because he's going to transfer out of metro. You know, if he breaks formation and goes out on his own, and quite often, you know, they're tempted to do this. They're at a situation at a university or something. The kids are throwing rotten eggs at them or something, and or throwing urine on them as it actually occurred. And this really will get someone teed off, you know, and they'll break ranks and they'll go after that individual. You've seen it happen in TV. Well, we tell them, if you break ranks, you just better keep on going. And you just better ask for a transfer out of this outfit because you're no use to us when you're like that. It's very important to work together as a team and not as an individual. Very important. We lose our efficiency. During the Watts riots, I was at 103rd Street in the fire station, and at 10 o'clock on Friday night, Friday the 13th, in 1965, I was at 103rd Street, and at about 10 o'clock at night, the fire station was assaulted, and there were about 250 to 300 people outside, and they were throwing Molotov cocktails at us, and a couple of them hit on the door of the fire station, and you know, the gasoline was ablaze, and the firemen were all gone. You know, they were out trying to put out other fires, and a sniper with a .22 rifle was sniping at us through the glass doors, through the glass at the top of the doors, and there were only about 15 of us left at the station. I deployed all the rest of the guys trying to evacuate people out of the area that wanted to get out, and I said, "Look, if we don't get out and do our thing right now, we're going to lose it. You know, they're going to wipe us out." And I said, "I want you guys in your squad formation," and they all lined up in a column of twos. I had the first four guys with shotguns and port arms. I said, "Put on your helmets." And when I opened this door, there was a doorway inside the sliding doors. You know what I mean? They're big sliding doors, and there was a little doorway cut. You've seen those old fire stations. I said, "When I open this door, I want you guys to run out in double time, counting cadence as we go." And we practiced a little bit inside before we did it. And then I stood by the door and I opened it up. And I said, "Go!" You know, and they started and I ran behind them. And there were, you know, seven guys in columns of twos, 14 altogether, and me bringing up the rear appropriately, you know. And that crowd of 250 to 300 people, with some of them arms, you know, rifles, and some of them Molotov cocktails, they broke and they ran when they saw us coming out in this organized way. You know, the psychology of organized guys that look like they know what they're doing, you know, and working together. It was amazing, you know, and of course it was what we planned on happening. And they ran so fast to get out of our way that they left there were several milk crates full of Molotov cocktails. You know, the bottles were already pre-made in the milk crates, and so we just picked those up and took back with us. And so we took away all their Molotov cocktails. We got out the fire that was on the door. But that really impressed me, and I thought, wow, the tremendous force of 14 organized guys against 250 disorganized with no plan. You know, incredible, the difference. And of course, you've heard the story about how communism got going. 15 or 16 men sat down and made a plan to take over the world, and they've got around two-thirds of it already under their control. You know, organized, dedicated, with a purpose, a team. Of course, that's not a good cause, but it's an example of what organization and what teamwork can do. Family cohesiveness. Let's look at this word. You've heard of this phrase, family cohesiveness, and we in law enforcement recognize that it's very important to have family cohesiveness to have a successful family. Well, what does it mean? Well, the word cohere means to become united in principles, relationships, or interests. And I think it's most important to be united in principles. You're already united in relationships when you're in a family. And I think interests can be somewhat important, but of primary importance is that first word, to become united in principles. You know, if you all share the same principles, if you have what psychologists and behavioral scientists now refer to as shared values, you know, you all share the same values, you'll be a family that really sticks together if you have shared values. Now, how are you going to have shared values? Why don't we have more family cohesiveness? Why don't we have more shared values today? We don't have much discussion about values. Lack of communications, going back to a couple of weeks ago. Lack of time just being together and talking about values and principles. You know, when you have principles that you all believe in, you really hang in there together. Yes. Yes. Comment is that maybe they all have their own standards upon which to base their principles. That's very true. Not enough masculine role players, that's right. That's what the whole course is about here, is that this is our job, to see that the family is united in this way, especially in this area of principles. And cohesion means merely the act or process of cohering together. Okay, let's look at the biblical basis. The biblical basis, going back to what we talked about a couple weeks ago when we were talking about... maybe 3 weeks ago when we were talking about the true masculine role, and in Ephesians 5, remember it talked about the woman being submissive to the man, and it likened the whole family relationship to the relationship between Christ and the church. That's really something. The family relationships are compared to Christ-church relationships. Very interesting. And the fact that Jesus Christ was the head of the church is the same way that we should be the head of our families and of our wives. The team concept is present in the body life concept. Taking a look at Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 12, where they talk about, where the Word of God talks about body life. You understand what body life is, that concept? We don't have time to go into it in depth tonight, but just to mention it, the whole concept of body life is that just like a body is not all one type of organ or a grouping of cells or function. It's a beautiful combination. Same way our family relationship should be. For instance, in my body, you know, just think of how bad it would be if every part of me was an index finger, or if every part of me was an eye, you know, or an ear. If I was just one great big ear, you know, an ear can't get along by itself. And an eye can't get along by itself. You know, it's a beautiful combination. Every member is needed. And every member edifies and is of value to the other members. And that, once again, should be the same relationship in our family. We shouldn't expect everyone to be the same. Now, I think the greatest thing you can do to your son, especially your first son, is to early in life let him know that you don't expect him to be exactly a carbon copy of you. And that really gets a lot of young men uptight, especially if you've been fairly successful. It really is very threatening, and it really builds up a lot of anxiety. I know some sons of some great men that are really having trouble in life today because they feel they have to live up to their dad's performance and be just like their dad. And you know, that's not the biblical concept. The Bible likens family relationships to the body life relationships that we have in Christ. And it's neat to have a right index finger and a left index finger and an ear and a big toe and everything else that forms the whole body. And every one of those things is performing a different function. And that's really good. And I'm sure that the egotistical thing to do is to want your children to be exactly like you. But that's not the godly thing to do. You know, God has made them a unique individual. It's important to recognize that and to let them know that, to put them at ease. You know, my boy is constantly coming to me and say, "Hey, Dad, when you were my age and when you were at school, what did you do here?" And he wants to know each and everything, and I have to share with him. And that's good to share. But then I have to stop and say, "Now, wait a minute, Bob. I want you to know that I recognize that you're not just like me. You've got a lot of me in you. You've got a lot of your mom in you. And you know what that does? That makes you a unique person. You're something where the mold was thrown away when God made you. There's nobody like you. And there's nobody just like me. And, you know, I don't expect you to be like me." And you can almost see that's great. He's free to be his own man. And that's good. I like to put a lot of my values into him because I think a lot of my values are biblical values, but that's different than wanting him to be like you. It's important to recognize that there are various talents or gifts. My son has a talent of writing poetry. It's hard for me to believe that, you know. The guy's 6'2", 180 pounds, 16-year-old, big for that age, you know. And the kid writes poetry. And he does it well. I never could write poetry. But, you know, I'm really encouraging him in that because he really can express himself. I think he could use that for the glory of God. And it never turned me on to write poetry. Never had been interested. But he does it well. I think it's important to recognize that God does different things with different people. Yeah, you're right. I guess it's and his comment was, "What's wrong with being 6'2", 180 pounds, and writing poetry? Like, I don't feel it's manly." I guess it's my stereotype, you know. I guess it's maybe the way I was brought up. Maybe my dad said some funny things about it. I don't know what the set is, but all of us come up with a different set, and my set is that's not super masculine, but there's nothing, as we've gone through our what is a true masculine role in the Scripture, there's nothing that says you can't write poetry, you know. Pardon me? He made a good point there. Who's going to question his manliness, huh? Big guy. Okay, that there's a union of parts in a team relationship in body life. And there's care for one another. There's another important thing in body life concept in Scripture, and that is that we are to sincerely care for one another. Last night, even though I wasn't feeling too hot, I had coming down with a cold, a fellow down the street that the Lord has laid on my heart to kind of disciple. He's a real talented guy. He had some things he wanted to talk over, and I had him come over, and I just spent about 3 hours just sitting up with him and just listening to him. And when he got all through, he said, "Man, you know, I just really appreciate you caring enough for me to sit up and listen to me for 3 hours. I know you have a lot to do, you know." And that's I got a blessing out of that, probably more than he did. It's amazing how the Lord blesses you, you know. But this concept of caring for one another is important not only in people outside your family, but you know, the natural thing to do is to take your family for granted and not do the same thing like that for your own children and your wife. And as I walked into the bedroom, my wife had already retired to the bedroom by the time this guy left, and she said, do you have some time to listen to me tonight? You know, yeah, I've been listening to the neighbor, you know. And I thought, wow, you know, hey, priorities. And I said, I really do. And I felt like I should go to sleep, but I said, no, let's talk. It's neat to listen and to care for one another and to be concerned about their needs. Sharing concepts are very important in this body-life relationship. I think it's important for us to look at some behavioral principles now so we can understand what the Word of God is saying when it talks about certain things. In Proverbs 27, well, there's some neat things in Proverbs, isn't there? About life. Proverbs 27:7. Even honey seems tasteless to a man who is full, but if he is hungry, he'll eat anything. Okay, you may wonder, how in the world is that going to apply to Maslow's hierarchy of needs? I think as we discuss Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you'll see that this verse is very much involved. First of all, I think it's important to get a little background here. Maslow is a gentleman who wrote a book called, in fact, he wrote several books. One of them was called A Theory of Human Motivation, The Basic Needs, A.H. Maslow. And he had a number of suppositions that he made and kind of a theory, a hypothesis that he set out. And he talked about his what he calls his hierarchy of needs. And he says, to begin with, man is perpetually a wanting creature. Okay, man is, first of all, perpetually a wanting creature. And he says that he has certain basic needs or wants that are arranged in a hierarchy, that is, one upon the other. He has basic needs or wants that are arranged in a hierarchy. And the third thing he says is that as the lower needs that are at the bottom of this hierarchy or stacking of needs are satisfied, higher needs become more apparent. In fact, he goes on to explain that if the lower needs are not satisfied, the higher needs are not too apparent. But he says as lower needs are satisfied, the higher needs become more apparent. Now you see how this verse comes into play? Even honey seems tasteless to a man who is full, but if he is hungry, he'll eat anything. Once a certain appetite has been fulfilled, maybe you've been eating just a bunch of bread or something and eat so much of it, even honey doesn't turn you on too much. That has been satisfied. You want to go on to something else. And so you see, in the Bible, if old Maslow had just consulted Proverbs, he'd have found out that that theory that he had wasn't too original after all. That concept was way back there in Proverbs, written by King Solomon. I'm going to put on the screen a triangle, which I think does it very well by explaining the hierarchy of needs. And it'll help you fill in your identifying the basic needs there, A through E. You see where it talks about psychological and then safety or security. This is how they go. That at the bottom of the pyramid or triangle are the physiological needs. You know, those are needs like wanting to be full, have your stomach full, you're hungry, clothing, that type of thing. The physiological needs. And once your physiological needs are fulfilled, you kind of start getting interested in security or safety needs. Such things as kind of a house, you know, having some place to stay, some permanency, some security. And after that is fulfilled, then you kind of start thinking about some higher needs like social needs, acceptance, love. Okay, at the bottom are the physiological needs, and then finally, next of all, the the security or safety needs, and then there's social or love or acceptance needs. And on top of that, once those needs are fulfilled, then you start thinking about your ego needs, your self-esteem, such things as recognition. And finally, at the top, self-actualization needs. And, you know, even Maslow wasn't quite sure what he meant when he said that. He said, I know there's something else, that even if you have your physiological needs satisfied, even if you have your safety needs and your social needs and even your ego needs, I know there's something beyond that, that even if all those needs are fulfilled, there's something else. I think I know what he was talking about, even though he didn't, maybe. I think he was talking about a real relationship with God and the sense that you're where God wants you to be. And you're allowing him to work through your life. You know, Maslow wasn't sure what those self-actualization needs was, but what he meant was, he tried to verbalize it by saying, reaching your full potential and kind of feeling good about life in general, philosophically. Now, let's try to explain a little bit more about Maslow's hierarchy of needs so you really understand what he's saying. He's saying that if you have a person who is getting $1,000 a month in money, he has a $30,000 home he's living in, he has a car, he has reasonable clothing, and he doesn't have any really outstanding bills, it's pretty hard to motivate that guy by saying, if you'll work a little harder, I'll give you a little more. Now, humanly speaking, it sounds like he should be motivated if you just offer him a little more. You know, if you'll just work a little harder, I'll give you another $200 a month. It seemed like that should work, doesn't it? You know, a lot of employers try that. But you want to know something? That really doesn't work. That no longer becomes a carrot out there if, assuming that he can live reasonably comfortable with that money that's coming in. If he can satisfy his basic needs of food, of shelter, of transportation, more money isn't going to really motivate him that much. It's not going to motivate him as much as the higher needs. Now, it'll motivate him some. We're not saying it ceases entirely to be a motivating cause, but it doesn't motivate him as much as these other needs. For instance, the need of esteem and of acceptance and love. I was on the plane with some guys from McDonald's. They were at the top of the McDonald's hierarchy. And they said, by the way, they were Christian guys. Yeah. And they were telling me a little bit about the management of McDonald's. And this one guy said, you know, one thing we've really learned a lot about people, we made these certificates. And he opened up his briefcase and he handed me one. He had one for $5, one for $10, one, for, I think, for $20. And he said, we drop in on McDonald's franchises and, you know, us, the top management. And there are a lot of us, you know, in management. And we all do this. We stop in one whenever, whatever city we're in, we try to stop in a few McDonald's. And we'll go up to the counter, and if the person that's waiting on us says all the right things, you know, thank you, sir, and have a good day and all that, we hand them one of these certificates that they can redeem for money. You know, right there. Turn in to your manager and $10 or $20, you know, for doing a good job. And he said something, I forget the exact figure, but I know it was over 85%. Do not turn them in. They do not turn them in. They don't redeem them for money. That's right. They keep them. They put them in their wallet, or they put them in a frame and put them hanging on their wall. They do something because that pat on the back, that recognition, is more important to them than money. Isn't that curious? That's an interesting phenomenon. It's an interesting commentary on human nature that really, that's very important to people, to have a pat on the back. I remember when I was at Action Investigation Division, I had a young sergeant come up to me and he said, Captain, I'd like to start the report of the week concept. I said, what? He said, yeah, you know, a report of the week. He said, we have a report auditor's office, right? I said, yeah. He said, we audit about 150 traffic reports a day, right? I said, yeah. He said, well, you know, they're in an excellent position to, once a week, out of the 150 reports they audit each week or each day, to select two or three outstanding investigations. And they can send them down to you, and you can pick the one that really you're impressed with, And you can just take a felt pen and you can, you know, write on that report, make a few comments about some good things they did, and then we'll post it in a portion of the bulletin board. We'll call it the report of the week. And I said, hey, Ben, we're dealing with police officers, not Sunday school kids. No, these are cops. They're not going to respond to something like this. He said, can we try it? Just a couple weeks? And I'd already told my subordinates, you know, I'll always be willing to try something. And I want to, you know, I didn't want to discourage him from new ideas and innovation by saying no. So I said, okay. So first couple weeks, you know, the reports came down, and I wrote on them and said, you know, good work, and then put my initials, RLV, you know. And of course, the guys, they're used to my initials on things where they got days off or something, you know, punishment of some type. So they knew who that was. So I put it on the board. And I kind of forgot about it. And about the third or fourth week, it was Friday, and I walked into the outer office where my secretary's office is, and I saw the guys lined up from the early day watch. They get off at 3:30, and they were standing around the watch commander's office. And I said, hey, this isn't Wednesday. Every other Wednesday we get paid. I said, this isn't Wednesday. What are the guys doing out in the watch commander's office? And she said, sir, you haven't signed the report of the week yet. I said, do you mean that grown policemen are out there waiting to see what report of the week's going to go up on the board? And she said, well, yes, sir. I said, well, give me those things. You know, and I wrote on one of them, and I put it up, and of course, when I did, you know, the guys kind of give one another gas on, you know, oh, look, who's up there, you know, and all that. But still, that really impressed him. And it meant a lot to him. And I kind of reformed some opinions I had about praise and about patting someone on the back. That's very important. Maslow's hierarchy of needs says that these higher needs, you know, most of us in our society today have had the first two fulfilled. And so the way we motivate people by way of teamwork and getting things done, the way you motivate other people in your family are through these higher needs of acceptance and praise and self-actualization. What is that? We'll get to that next week when we talk about your role as family priest. Let's get back to the outline. A guy by the name of Douglas McGregor wrote a book called The Human Side of Enterprise. He also is a behavioral scientist, and he proposed a couple theories that he referred to his X and Y theories. And both theories were theories of how to motivate people to get work done. And his X theory made some basic assumptions. Assumption number one, that the average human has an inherent dislike for work, and that he will avoid it if he can. Okay, the fill-in there is he has a dislike of work and will avoid it if he can. Secondly, most people must be coerced, controlled, directed, or threatened with punishment in order to motivate them. You know, you do this or else. Okay, let me read that again. Most people must be coerced, controlled, directed, or threatened with punishment to motivate them. Still theory X. Third assumption, the average person prefers to be directed, and he wishes to avoid responsibility. He has little ambition, and he wants security above all. How many of you guys are either supervisors or some kind of managers? How many of you feel this way? A lot of you, yeah. How many of you feel that way about your children? Be honest now. A lot of you. Okay, that's your theory X type people in. Theory Y, he has some assumptions that go like this. Expenditures of physical and mental effort is as natural as play or rest. That's assumption number one. It's as natural as play or rest. Number two, control and threats are not the only way to bring about effort. You know, saying you either do this or else is not the only way to get it done. Man will exercise self-direction and self-control in the service of objectives to which he is committed. He will exercise self-direction and self-control in the service of objectives to which he is committed. You know what the most important phrase in that assumption is? To which he is committed. D, commitment to objectives is a function of the rewards associated with their achievement. Now, those are pretty good concepts to consider, but remember, there are theories of a man, okay? Let me give you a biblical principle on motivation. Proverbs 13:19, reading from the Living, it is pleasant to see plans develop. That is why fools refuse to give them up even when they are wrong. Now, you see the wisdom in that statement? You see what he's saying? He's talking about being committed to objectives to which you have had some input in a setting. You know, this is getting back to a management style now that many people call management by objectives, or MBO. They say if you want your employees to really be committed to your objectives, make sure they have a kind of a piece of the action as far as setting the objective. And, you know, I call this the smorgasbord principle. Now, the reason I call it the smorgasbord principle is I noticed something about my kids when they were little. They didn't like vegetables. Your kids like that? I think every child is like that at one point or another, where they don't like vegetables. They have to be taught how to eat vegetables. And my kids were no different than anyone else's. And so, you know, as my mother did with me, when came time to eat, why, she would put a little spinach on my plate and some beets, you know, and all these bad tasting things when you're a little kid. And she'd make me eat them. And so I'd do the same thing. I'd say, now you have to learn how to eat them. And by the way, that works. I kind of like all those things now. You know, eating them all the time, I finally acquired a taste for them. But anyhow, my son was ingenious. You know, he tried all different techniques in beating the system. He had the old hide it under the potato skin trick, you know, where, you know, I'd look on his plate and the vegetables were all gone. I'd lift up the potato skin. There they are, you know. And then there's the spread it over the plate trick, you know. That's where you take a little pile of spinach and you diffuse it all over the whole plate. And it doesn't look like there's anything there, you know. You scrape it into a pile and it's the same amount you began with, you know. It's amazing. Well, he had all those tricks and a few more. And yet, I noticed a strange phenomenon that would occur when we'd go to a smorgasbord. You've been to a smorgasbord when you think you're getting something and it's something else. You know what I mean? They color things and put everything in Jello and, you know, all that. And you're not sure quite what you're getting, but it looks kind of good, so you take a little bit. And maybe you don't like fish, but you find out when you took that Jello that it's fish in Jello. You know, I've actually had fish and Jello before, really. But anyhow, there it is, you know. And yet, I noticed something strange. Although Bob, when I would put it on his plate, would use all these tricks not to eat it. When he would put it on his own plate from the smorgasbord, he would finish it. Really. Notice next time you go to a smorgasbord, how many people leave a bunch of stuff on their plate. Very few people leave anything on their plate. You know, strange things happen when you commit yourself and say, I will eat this, and you put it on your plate, you eat it. Eat if you don't like it, you know. It's kind of embarrassing not to eat something that you have put there. Now, when your mom has put it there, or when someone else has put it on your plate, there's no ego involvement. Sure, you know, you leave it. You do your best not to eat it. But when you have put it on your plate, it's kind of saying, I goofed, and we don't like to do that, do we? And so we eat it anyhow, you know. We don't like it, but we don't want to look foolish by leaving it on our plate. No, really. And I think that's really what's contained in this beautiful piece of wisdom in Proverbs, where it says that it is pleasant to see plans develop. You know, when you've made the plans, it's really beautiful to watch them develop. That is why fools refuse to give them up even when they are wrong. Even if you get halfway through the plan, you find out it's not working, you're going to make it work, you know. You've worked for bosses like that, haven't you? They'll tell you to do something, you go back and say, hey, it's not working, boss. It will work. We will make it work, you know, because it's his plan. It's kind of that way, and that's what McGregor was saying about people and about being a good boss and a good team builder. That when members of your team, whether it be a factory of people or whether it be a family of four, when they all feel as though they've had some input and it's their plan, not the old man's plan that everyone's going to follow, but it's their plan that they've had some input into setting the objectives, they're going to be more committed to those objectives. I think it is very important to remember these concepts about people and use them as a kind of a background for setting objectives and helping our children set objectives. It is very important to have objectives set. If you don't have any goals, you don't have any accomplishments, really. It's just like jumping in a ship and saying, where should we go? And saying, well, let the ship go where it wants to go. You know, you're never going to get where you want to because you don't know where you want to go. It's good to have goals. A team needs purpose. And all of this information tonight has to do with team building. And your family team needs purpose. They need objectives. They need to know which direction they're going. Even if you don't have children, even if you don't plan on ever having children, if for some reason that's impossible, still your family, you and your wife, need plans, need objectives, need purpose. Objectives allow programming of activities, and it prevents wheel spinning. It prevents you from doing superfluous things, things that don't really count. You know, we don't have much time, really. I'm reminded of a verse out of Psalms, in the Living Psalms. It goes like this. It says, help me to understand how few days we have. May I make the most of them, or words to that effect. And the idea is that since we don't have too much time, really, and it's getting to seem even more so every day, you know, that we're approaching the time when the Lord's coming, we don't really have much time here on earth. It's important to make the best of the time that we have. It's important to set priorities and do what's really most important. If you don't have plans and objectives, you can't set priorities. And if you don't set priorities, you'll find yourself doing a lot of things that you don't really consider too important, and missing those things that later on you look back and say, hey, that was pretty important and I didn't do it, and you're sorry about it. It gives meaning to tasks, and that's very important. A person needs to know about meaning to what they're doing, to understand the whole purpose of this. If they only have, for instance, a piece of the action, like in an assembly line, and they only put on four bolts every time something comes by them, it's pretty hard to get that fellow enthused about his job and to do it well unless he understands why he's putting on those four bolts. And companies who have done a lot of research in this area have found that it's important to take a guy who has a menial task of putting on four bolts every time something goes by and take him down the line. Somebody mentioned this at the break. And said, you mean taking the assembly worker all the way down the assembly line? Yeah, that's right. So he gets to fit in his reason for being there on the line with a total objective, and he sees the car come out the other side and he sees his bolts still on the car. Hey, yeah, I put those there, you know. And he sees the reason for those things being there. It gives meaning to the task. So it's good to know about the objectives and to have them. Now, there's some principles involved. Number one, it's got to be seeking God's guidance. I have a tape that they've cut here at the church called "And He Shall Direct Thy Paths," and it's taken from Proverbs 3:5-6. And just to give you a quick summary of the tape, it goes like this. There are three conditions to having God's direction in your life, and they're found in Proverbs 3:5-6. Number one is trust in the Lord with all your heart. Number two, lean not into your own understanding. And of course, the antithesis of that is to follow his understanding, which is in his book. And three, in all your ways acknowledge him. And so it's important at the very beginning of setting objectives to seek God's guidance as the director of your family. It's very important. for you to seek God's guidance and to let the rest of your family members know you're doing this. And then, remember, looking back to some of these principles we've talked about, involve the participants. Okay, let me give you a practical example. It's Saturday, and I want Bob to do some yard work. And I sit down with him. I say, now, you know, I had to go through this quite a few years ago. I said, now, Bob, do you think it's nice to have a neat, good-appearing yard? He wasn't too sure about that, you know, because he knew what was coming next. So we talked about that for a while, and finally, he kind of hesitantly agreed that, yeah, it's probably a good idea to have a, you know, it's probably a good Christian thing to do, you know, a Christian witness for the neighbors, not to have a trashy-looking yard. So I said, okay, look, I'd like for you to work in the yard today, and this afternoon we're going to do this together, but in the morning we're going to work, and I kind of want to put you on your own. There are some things that I think need to be done. Let's just walk around, and we'll look around together. We walked around. I pointed several things out. I said, now, what do you think you can do today? Okay, what am I doing? What? Okay, but what am I doing with the objectives? I'm getting him to commit himself to the objectives. See, I'm not saying, now, I want you to move the wood pile and put it over here, and I want you to do this, and I want you to do that. Instead, I ask him, what do you think you can do today? And I was kind of amazed to find out. He said, well, I think I could wash those windows. I think I could clean up that trash there. I think I can prune that tree. I think I can. He got about down to number four, and I said, wait a minute. I don't think you're going to be able to do much more than that by noon. Instead of having to encourage him to do more, I had to cut him off. Really. And man, you ought to have seen that kid work that morning. First time I tried it. It was after I had developed this outline here a couple years ago. You know, and I went, why didn't I do that all my life? You know, it worked so neat. Because they were his objectives. It was his plan. And he had told his dad, I think I can do that. And for him not to be able to do it by noon was really a cop-out. Now, if I told him, because I remember what used to be, Bob, I want you to move the wood pile. I want you to pick up the trash. I want you to wash the windows. He'd dink around in the backyard and, oh, you know, and Ron come noon, and he'd only have one or two things done. And just when they were his objectives, he's hustling around. He's trying to get, looking at his watch, you know, trying to hurry up and get done. It's amazing. So it's important, I think, remembering some of the principles we talked about earlier to involve the participants, you know, the smorgasbord technique. That's a biblical principle. It's pleasant to see plans develop. You know, he planned it. I will move this. I will do that. I will do this. It's his plan. Make appropriate plans. Proverbs 13:16 has something to say about that. And then I think it's important to prepare sub-goals. In many cases, if it's a difficult objective to achieve or it's kind of complex, it's good sometime to work backwards. And I think it's very important, especially with young people, looking a long ways ahead in life to set up a series of sub-goals. And I like to use what I call a stair technique, where I start out, I don't put the stairs first, but I remember talking with Bob one day, and I said, Bob, when you're 30 years old, what kind of a house would you like to live in? He said, oh, you know, I like a house, and he described it. I said, man, you're talking about $60,000, about $60,000. He said, really? I said, you really are. He said, well, that's what I want. I said, what kind of car you want? He says, I want a Corvette. Okay. And we named a bunch of other things. I said, okay. I said, you know, we talked about some other things too, but just in the physical area, let's just handle the physical material things first of all. You really want that? Yeah, I'd kind of like that. I said, okay, why don't you go out and buy it tomorrow? He said, man, I don't have the bread. I said, well, you mean you need to get the money. That's right. Well, why don't you get the money? Well, I don't have that kind of job. What kind of job would you have to live in a $60,000 home? Well, I don't know. I probably have to make somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000 a year. I said, why don't you go out and get that kind of a job? Job here. $20,000 a year. Okay. Why don't you go and get that tomorrow? Man, I can't get a $20,000 job tomorrow. Why not? I'm not qualified. What do you think you're going to need for that? I need preparation. Well, what kind? You know, and I'm kind of simplifying it now. It took a lot longer for us to go down these steps. You need college. Oh, you need college. Good. Maybe some further training after college, but at least you need college. Now he's persistent about. See, I wanted to talk to him about him doing his homework. But you see, what you do is you start way up here, and you go down here until it gets down to where this means something to him, and then he can see how that relates to up here. Now, you know, many times, especially with younger kids, we assume that they can see this natural progression. And that's why a lot of kids are not getting prepared for a proper type of education. Oh, for instance, another thing we went through. He said, you know, I would really like to be a speaker, like John MacArthur or Ken Porn. I said, why don't you go out and do that tomorrow? And we went through the same thing. Now, this is on the physical realm. We went through the same thing in the spiritual area and in being prepared to rightly divide the word of truth, you know. And we went through the same thing. You know, man, John went to seminary. In order to go to seminary, you have to go to college. And we went through the same deal, you know. And suddenly he started seeing that, hey, you have to begin now to get to where you're going to be in 10 years from now. You have to set some sub-goals. In short, setting sub-goals and relating them to the overall objective adds meaning to those sub-goals when you relate them. When you relate these classes in high school to this goal way here at the end of the staircase, it adds meaning to this class in Spanish that he doesn't like, or history, or math, or whatever it is, you know, to get him ready for this. I'm reminded of the story of Johnny Unitas, and I know you guys know who he is, you know, one of the greatest passers the world has ever seen in football. And as many of you probably have heard, Johnny Unitas never played high school or college football. Did you know that? He played sandlot football, and he went directly from sandlot football to the pros. That's amazing. Did you know that? Incredible. And you know how he got there? In an interview. He said when he was a kid, he used to stand back and he hung up a tire from a tree and he would throw the football through the tire. And then he'd back up and he'd throw the football through the tire. And he said sometime he could get someone to chase a football for him, but most of the time he couldn't. And he had to chase it himself. And he said, you know, that wasn't fun, to throw a football and miss half the time and then have to chase it and then go back. But he said, I never lost sight of the objective, and the objective was to be the world's greatest football passer, the world's greatest quarterback. And as long as he kept his eyes on the objective, this step down here of passing it through the tire took on meaning, see? Three things can be said about successful people, and we went through this the first week, I think, and that is that they're objective-oriented, they have a deep sense of responsibility, and they have a good self-image. Those are three very important components of a successful person in any field, however you define success. And this being objective-oriented, having objectives, they're the people that get to the objective because they have an objective. You know, they're not drifting in life. They have directions they're going. And this also, by the way, all of these principles apply in the spiritual area. You know, what kind of objectives do you have spiritually? And what kind of sub-goals? Do you have any sub-goals of memorizing X number of verses a month? Of going through so many books by December of this year in the Bible? You really should. As a Christian, you should have some overall objectives and some sub-goals in order to get there. Very important. And it's our responsibility as the leader of the family, the team leader, to set these sub-goals and these overall objectives. And then delegate authority. You know, anytime you get people involved under you, you have to delegate to them the authority to do that task. And I see this really works with kids. You know, when you give them something to do. I remember looking out at the side of the house and there were a bunch of weeds and I said, hey, Bob, what do you think you could do here? He said, "What do you mean? What do you think I can do?" I said, "Well, you know, this looks pretty bad, and your mom would like to grow some flowers here. Do you think you can get a flower bed worked up here somehow?" "Yeah, I probably could." "Well, I'll tell you what. Anything that we have, or any equipment or supplies that you need, I'll pay for it. If you think you can do this, I'm just going to delegate the authority to you, and you just whatever you want." So I walk back in the house, and he's there scratching his head, and he's looking, you know. He saw his mind. I came back out a few minutes, and he said, "I'm going to need some bricks." I said, "How many?" He says, "Well, I got the kind of border I put around here. I'm going to put bricks. I've seen them before. They're kind of on an angle like that. You put them like that." And he says, that's the kind of thing I want to do." I said, "Okay, I got a bunch of bricks over there. I was going to use them for something else, but, you know, they're yours." Yeah. Delegate authority, you know. If you're going to give them responsibility, okay, you've got them. They're yours. "Well, I'm going to need a terrace this. You know, I'm going to have to change the structure here." And I'm going to have to, I said, "Okay, you have my, you know, it's you're the boss. You're in charge." And the guy, he had it all planned. Man, he's out there digging and making bricks and, you know. He worked out there all day. And when he got through, you know, he's really proud of his work, which brings us to the next point. Not only is it important to set objectives, but if you have objectives, you've got to measure accomplishment in relationship to those objectives. A lot of bosses set objectives, but they don't go back and measure accomplishment. I thought it was so important to measure accomplishments that when I was out at Venice Division, and I'm doing the same right now in my new command, I have them set various objectives each year, each fiscal year. And then, for instance, in the area of burglaries, I said, "Okay, gentlemen, last year, here's how the burglary situation was. January, February, March, April, May, and so on, you know. In January, we had 150 burglaries. In February, we had 205, and so on. And they kind of jumped around, and in the summer, they went up a little bit, and then they came down. And so we kind of grafted out the burglaries for that year. And I said, "Now, what do you think you guys can do?" Talking to the lieutenants, you know. "Well, we think we can reduce the burglaries." You know, this was after long discussions and talking about data. Maybe 15, 20 minutes later, they thought they could come up with about 11% decrease in burglaries. I said, "Okay, 11% means this many here." And we drew another graph that showed a 11% decrease every month all the way along the line. Then I had my analytical guy prepare a chart like that for that next year coming up. And I said, "Now, this is our goal. It's under last year. And we're going to chart out where we really are so we can visually see how we're doing." And we did that. And we start out a little high. And then they knocked down. It went under. And it went over a little bit. Then under. And so we went. And, you know, by golly, at the end of the year, we were under where we had been the year before. We met our goal. But it was important to see how we were doing, because every now and then we'd go up over and they'd say, "Uh-oh, we're over," you know, and they'd get all excited about it and get on their man, you know, and somehow they'd get the burglaries down. I think that's neat, to measure accomplishments and to let people know how they're doing. And, you know, it's good to go out, once again, getting back to the family situation, it's good to go out once in a while. Your son's working out there and, "Hey, this is really progressing nice. Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, you got that worked out good there, and those bricks. That's great, Bob. That's a good idea. Let me suggest this over here, you know." You know, so you give a little input, too, a little reflection on how he's doing. That shows your interest. But it's good for you, too, to measure accomplishments of the family. And so we should have points of kind of review on how we're doing. Some people have tried the technique of writing themselves a letter at the beginning of a year and saying that, you know, this year I'm going to accomplish the following thing. And then quarterly they take out that letter and look at it. And wow, you know, they've almost forgotten what they said they wanted to do. And suddenly they find out, whoops, I'm way under where I'm supposed to be by this time. That's a good idea. Grant recognition and rewards. And the thing that, getting back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we really need to pat people on the back. And when your wife or your son or your daughter or anybody in your family really does a good job, let's let them know it. And let them know as soon as possible. And then you just commit it to the Lord. Commit your way to the Lord. He will bring it to pass, it says in Proverbs. Objective setting, a very important phase of fulfilling the true masculine role. Very important. And you know what? One of the most neglected areas of traditional American family life. Not too many men function as an objective setter in their family situation. A lot of it is done kind of haphazard, and it's kind of a rule by emotions and kind of impulsiveness. You know, whatever at the moment turns you on, you do. That's not the way we're really supposed to live. We're supposed to live orderly lives that are committed, and we get this commitment by bringing people in on the plans and allowing them to have some input, getting their commitment, measuring their progress and rewarding them. And the same with ourselves. All these principles apply to self-discipline too. Objective setting, very important. Okay, next week we'll finish up this outline. We'll also go into probably the most important role you have is the role of family priest. We're going to cover that next week. Please don't miss that one. That's the most important one of the whole session.